Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I was thinking about what to talk about this afternoon. Thinking about the past Thanksgiving retreats, including this one, and the topics that I've often spoken around are things like death, impermanence, body parts. And I thought, well, I might need to break this trend a little bit. I don't want to get a bad rep. And I also was very inspired with Lungpa's talk this morning. And also, there's been some questions that people have asked around gladdening the mind, softening the mind. Yeah, I was just appreciating the comments this morning about how it's so easy to get lost in techniques and ideals of meditation practice that a lot of us hold to and doggedly pursue. Also, in my own practice, just very much appreciating and continuing to realize how very, very important establishing that basic openness and contentment and ease of mind, softness in the mind, how important that is, and pretty much how indispensable actually it is, because it's just so difficult to sit down and watch the breath, develop some concentration when there isn't that basic openness and stability in the mind from all of the other practices that we can do. It's like I think everybody who's practiced for some period of time, has experienced many times, if not a lot of the time, this sense of practice being stale, of not getting anywhere, going through a dark period where it seems like you sit down and you just, boy, have I ever meditated before? You sit down and you try and do what the books tell you to do and what the teachers have told you to do and, establish mindfulness in front of you and set aside the defilements, watch the breath, and move into first jhana. And then 10 minutes later, second jhana. Then the release through true liberation occurs by the end of 45 minutes. That's what we that's what we sometimes carry with us as an ideal. So, and then, stark reality hits us day after day after day, and we don't measure up to that up to that expectation. So just recognizing that everybody goes through those periods, even people who have been meditating for many, many, many years, and you do have this question. You're like, what's going on here? And it's a real trap because in a talk that Lungpa gave some time ago, but was just recently printed as a talk in a small booklet, where he was talking about how we measure success in practice. It's so easy to be attached to the idea that success means having a pleasant meditation experience, developing some sort of blissful state of mind or peaceful state of mind, and that we cling to that idea, and if we don't get that, then we haven't been successful. And it's the same kind of thing that we're bringing into meditation practice. We find ourselves pretty much knocking up against all the time. It's that pursuit of pleasant feeling and the avoidance of painful feeling, and completely missing everything in between. And so bringing that judging mind into the practice of well, you know, if I'm not experiencing pleasant states of mind, then I'm a failure. This is not being successful. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. I'm doing something wrong. You know, might as well just give up. So again, that's just something that we all, I think, fall into, that habitual kind of response state based on that notion of a false idea of what it is to be successful in meditation practice. And I find that it's real useful when those kinds of periods come to just step back and remember that the meditation practice, the actual development of samadhi, even sometimes just trying to develop basic mindfulness, that those are very important parts of the path and the practice. And in coming to a meditation retreat, that's to some extent what we expect to be engaged in. But whether it's on a meditation retreat or in our daily life, when we're going through these periods of difficulty or stale practice, it's really good to remember that there is an eightfold path. It's not a one-fold path. It's not just concentration, but there are many other factors to developing the freedom of mind that we're all looking for. That even if things aren't going so well in the Sama Samadhi department, that there's a whole lot of other ways to focus our energies that are timely, useful, supportive, and contributing equally, you know, to the full path, the full development of freedom. And that really, you know, even in the suttas, the Buddha talks about that samadhi or sama samadhi, right samadhi, is dependent on all of those other factors in the Eightfold Path. You can't have sama samadhi, right concentration, without the development of all the skillful means of sila, right speech, right action, and of course, right livelihood, and also mind states that are supportive as that basic underlying layer of attitude. Not to mention right view. Why are we doing this in the first place? It's kind of like I think of, you know, those times when things are feeling, and when you're feeling a little bit lost or stale. It's I think it's useful to think of that as kind of just part of a cycle of nature. You know, in the winter time, all the plants, you know, all the growth period, the production period, all the flowering and seeding, bells and whistles, and beauty of springtime and summertime, those have died back. You know, all of that, all of those visible signs of activity have kind of died back, and a plant then goes kind of more into a deeper, we think of it as a dormant stage when nothing's happening, but what's happening is the roots are just getting stronger. The roots are going deeper during that winter period, during that quiet period, stretching out, finding places in the soil where there's more nutrition. The winter period, you know, oftentimes is a time when the moisture starts to really seep deep into the soil and allows those roots to grow and develop and spread and keep on forming that firm foundation. And if that didn't happen, then there would absolutely be no way that the plant could, could then start up and reinvigorate itself in the growing season. So that's, I think that's what we can expect to happen. We go through these cycles, just as in nature, and have to kind of regroup and go quiet and focus on other things, focus on the development of these supportive conditions that will, eventually support our meditation practice when things start to go through the natural cycle again. Yeah, sometimes it's hard because we think, this is a very long winter. I feel like I'm living in the Arctic when there's only maybe 1 month at that of success. But it's just really good to remember that is part of our practice. So there's always that constant. And it's good to recollect those kinds of aspects too, just in quiet moments. Really, check on yourself. How am I holding the development of the foundational practices, the sila? Am I, fulfilling those aspects of practice in the best possible way? And recognizing that you can do that. It's not that tall an order. And when you are successful, remembering that, bringing that into conscious awareness, and comparing it to say, times before when you hadn't been following precepts. And just the ease of mind, knowing that at the very least, even if you're a basket case, and if your mind is all over the place, at least you're living a life that's really engaged with consideration of yourself, other people, the world around you, not refraining from harming yourself or others, and the level of that, what a gift that is to yourself and to the world, and how probably 99% of the world isn't doing it at that level of scrupulousness. So just even if that's all we did, what a much better place this world would be, and what a much better frame of mind we'd all be in. So just recollecting that is an outstanding practice in itself. So even during, these periods of stale practice, we still do try sometimes to sit down and engage in some formal meditation practice. It's a recommended and good thing to do that, even when times are feeling pretty stale. And the trick during those times is to not get too lost in the particular difficult mind states. There's many layers to the mind, many different layers of activity that go on inside of us. There was a talk that I was giving, I think, a number of weeks or months ago by a Geary, and I was reflecting about the layers of mind kind of being like a septic tank. And as I went to explain that simile, I realized that most people were looking at me with a blank stare, so I don't think I'll do that one again. I had just been doing a lot of work on our septic tank thing. But needless to say, there are many layers to the mind. And they're not all so beautiful. Can be a bit smelly. But oftentimes when we're in the kind of the darker states, or kind of stale periods, it's so easy just to see that top layer and not go any deeper. I just get so lost in that basic surface layer, you know, and you know, maybe people experience it in different ways, but for myself, it's that layer of thoughts and ideas that's right on top. The stories that we tell ourselves, you know, whether it's opinions about the world around us or opinions about ourselves or thoughts of fantasy or thoughts of irritation or ill will, indignation is a good one. I think a lot of us can get caught in good old righteous indignation, something that's not right, that shouldn't be the way it is, and all the things that we would like to see different around those things. Anxiety, self-deprecation, depression. The world of ideas and thoughts are kind of right there on the top. And most of us, I think, spend a lot of time hanging out there and responding to that and kind of vaguely aware to some extent of when they're pleasant or unpleasant. And usually without too much recognition or consideration of those particular underlying feelings, we react in either moving towards something that's pleasant, moving away from something that's unpleasant, and as I said before, completely missing all the in-between. And as Lumpa has been talking about, particularly earlier in this retreat, it's that movement of mind that is really suffering when the mind moves from its base of clear awareness, chasing after different ideas, different desires or passions, or wanting to move away from difficulties or bad moods. There's where the suffering starts. But we're often not aware of that layer that's just below these thoughts and ideas. And, you know, it's there underneath, kind of informing us what we should do. But we seek solace in more thoughts or ideas that we think are going to be more pleasant, ways to deal with things externally, ways to handle issues or problems, or deal with unpleasant circumstances to make them pleasant again. And the machinations just go on and on and on. We keep creating more formations, more mental formations, more thoughts and ideas that have their own feelings associated with them. And we keep on trying to tweak it all so that it feels better. And it's kind of an endless process. So sometimes it's just really important, and it's so easy to get lost in those, because the desire and the drive for happiness and for having pleasant states of mind is so strong that we'll just kind of do anything out of desperation to have that kind of experience, and we forget to actually set down the story. In the realization that tweaking the story isn't gonna take care of that underlying sense of dis-ease. And sometimes you just have to. I find that more and more, as soon as I recognize that there's an unpleasant thing happening, or an unpleasant mood, or a sense of unright, something that's not right, or whatever it is, I just I find that it's more and more important just to refuse to go there, and not to feed that process, not to get lost in the story. And sometimes it takes a real strength of mind to just, as soon as it's recognized, to just say, put that down. You know, no need to go there on that level. And it's very hard because that's where the habit is so strong, is to just keep on moving in that train. And it doesn't mean to deny it or to repress it. I think that's, you know, something that people fear is that, you know, by establishing some firmness in the mind that you're moving into denial or repression, or you're not owning up to your anger, or you're not experiencing the fullness of you know, your experience, that you have to be completely allowing of anything that comes up, no matter what it's doing. But what I'm suggesting is that you just drop that top layer, or allow yourself to move just another layer deeper, to moving towards that more of that level of feeling and perception that's underneath the storyline, and really experiencing the feeling itself, and being willing to just embrace and hold and be with the sense of discomfort of that movement of mind, without thinking about it, without trying to problem solve it, without trying to rationalize it, but just to be with the feeling itself. And kind of paradoxically, the best way to do that is by attending to the body, because all of these kinds of feelings and emotions have their expression in the physical body. And that's where I find, anyway, is the most fruitful place to experience what's really going on at a slightly deeper level. So just really catching yourself, consciously setting aside the story. It's like, okay, I know from experience over many, many, many years that if I keep on thinking about this, it's just going to reinforce it. The reason I'm thinking about it is because I'm trying to avoid feeling an unpleasant feeling. And I know that if I just allow myself to feel that slight or strong unpleasantness in the body as is expressing itself, then it's not going to be real enjoyable for a few minutes. But if I can really attend to that, really hold that, and really develop a sense of patience and openness and kind regard for that feeling, just as it is, give it the space in the mind, and be with it, let it be present, then that in itself allows it to be there, live its life, and then fade away on its own natural course. So it's developing that kind of that bravery to be with it, to set aside all of the mental machinations that are trying to push it away or explain it away, and just to sit there with the feeling in the body and be kind to it. I think that when, you know, a lot of times when we're talking about things like the hindrances and the antidotes to the hindrances, like say for ill will or aversion, you know, it's sort of like loving kindness, and so often I think we can get lost in the idea that we're supposed to be having loving kindness for the object of our difficulty, but actually I think it's really what we need to have the loving kindness and spaciousness for is for the the experience or the hindrance itself, the actual feeling of the hindrance. And once that's established, then the mind is more able to extend that to the object. But most of the time we can't do that for the object of our difficulty right from the beginning. We need to steer that open-hearted state of mind to the experience that we feel. So sometimes I think a useful thing to do as part of that process for me is asking the right questions of myself. One can frame this kind of investigation in terms of skillful questions. This is sort of the process of Dhamma Vicaya, as some of you probably recognize, the second step in the seven factors of enlightenment, the second factor of enlightenment, Dhamma Vicaya, investigation of states. And essentially it's investigating, you know, what is present? Are there skillful states of mind present? Are there unskillful states? Is there wholesome or unwholesome activities going on in the mind? Asking yourself this question. And you know, you can phrase that in different ways. If you're not quite sure what it is, you can kind of go through a list of if it feels unskillful, feels unpleasant, then asking yourself, you know, where does it fall into, in say, in terms of the hindrances. But also, I think a real important part of that process is not to get lost in finding the problem, although that is useful. As I was just talking about, to really get down to the feeling at hand, but then to also phrase a question, pose a question. Well, what, instead of attending to negative states of mind and reinforcing them on that surface level, are there some wholesome states of mind that would be useful to attend to? Are there some wholesome activities of mind that I can switch my attention to? And this is what Paul was talking about this morning, is the importance of establishing those very wholesome states of mind as a basis for practice, just a basis for our lives, not getting too lost in specific techniques or strategies, but just developing these really gentle, peaceful, open qualities of mind from which the meditation practice can spring. You know, basic causes of happiness in the light mind, softening the mind, gladdening the mind. And he spent a good part of that talk this morning talking about gratitude, which is covers a lot of different aspects of how we can be in the world. There's a number of different reflections, ways that we can, you know, bring that softness into our lives, that basic happiness and gladness in what we do, developing that sense of appreciation, that sense of giving, just with how we are in the world, the things we do on a daily basis. And then when it actually comes time to sit down and review or to do some quiet practice, actually bringing those into recollection as active recollections when we first sit down can be a really useful thing, noticing the mood of the mind and attending to, you know, skillfully attending to developing a wholesome state of mind by recollecting those good things that are around us and about us and that we've participated in. to soften, gladden the mind. One of the we did some Upasaka days this last year on softening and gladdening the mind, and the part that I had kind of prepared for and talked about was one of those called Chaga Nusati, and then Upasama Nusati. Chaga Nusati, Chaga being kind of another word for generosity or giving. Dana is the one that most of us are familiar with. But Chaga is kind of a similar word with similar meaning, but in my mind anyway, it's sort of a bit of an enhanced kind of meaning around the word generosity or giving with several nuances in it. But that's one of the recollections, one of the six recollections that the Buddha suggests that are very useful for establishing these wholesome states of mind. And there's several different aspects of it, whether you're talking about dana or chaga. The first layer of that is the giving or the generosity that we can practice in giving of material goods, material support to people in need, to those who have less than we do. We have so much in this world, and part of our livelihood, part of our right livelihood, can be in offering some of what we have to people who are in need, and experiencing the pleasantness and the openness and the state of mind that comes when we recollect when we've done that. Whether it's in material goods or whether it's in service or time spent with somebody who's in need. And just bringing that up in mind as a recollection is a way of immediately softening the mind. I can remember for maybe it was about 3 or 4 years ago when my mother was having a very difficult time living alone, and it became clear that she really needed some support, some intervention. She had fallen a number of times and was trying to make it on her own, but clearly we were getting lots of warning signals and messages that something needs to be done. So Gail, my sister, and I went down to Florida where she was and spent a while there kind of assessing the situation and realizing that it was time that she shouldn't be living alone anymore. And working through all the difficulties, trying to get her convinced of that, and getting her packed up and moved so that she could be closer to, eventually up in Massachusetts with Gail, to be closer to help and family. And as difficult as it was, it just felt so good to be able to, even kind of against her will, it was, we knew that it was something that we could do to help her, and was something that she really needed and would eventually really benefit from. And as well as some of the difficult periods during those few days of getting this all worked out, there were some incredible moments of tenderness and vulnerability and intimacy that are rare occasions, I think, too rare. But it was a chance, it was an opportunity to be able to repay some of that debt of gratitude that we can have for what our parents have brought to us, having raised us and given us all the supports to get to where we are today, even if there were difficulties in the relationship or problems in the relationship, you can at least appreciate that our parents have done that much for us, given us this opportunity to have a human life in this, and to be able to practice Dhamma, and to be able to repay that in any way possible is a great gift. And again, through all the difficulties, the memories that remain from that, and that I used for a lot of time in my meditation for months and even years after that, were just bringing up that recollection of being able to support and offer that kind of care and attention in a very difficult, vulnerable situation. And how much that just softens the mind and makes the rest of the problems kind of fade away. So using those recollections, using those opportunities to recollect the goodness that we've done, and the recollection of times when people have done the same for us. It's so easy to get lost in the what's wrong with the world that and it's refreshing to remember that there are times when people have helped us when we've been in a difficult situation, to realize that there are times that people have really come to our aid and really supported us, and remembering the kindness that has come our way through many different people's acts of generosity. So it goes both ways. And remembering them, I find, it just really helps to ease the mind, settle the mind, and establish that kind of malleability in a tense mind. So recollection of generosity. There's also kind of another layer up of in chaga giving, dana, that's sometimes called abhaya dana, the gift of fearlessness. And that's where our recollection of our sila, our precepts, can come into play. The recollection of harmlessness, abhaya dana, is the giving of fearlessness. And pretty much that's described as the gift that we can give of safety to people in the world just by practicing precepts of harmlessness, not taking life. People and animals don't have to feel threatened when we're around. And you can see that, say, at the monastery when we're walking through and you practically trip over the deer. They don't run away. Or some of the other animals in the forest. There's just a sense of safety. They know that we're not going to harm them. And the people that come to the monastery have that that sense of refuge as well. They know, okay, well, at least there's one place in the world, or here's some people that I can feel completely safe around. They're not going to harm me, at least intentionally. They're not going to take advantage of me. They're not going to take my possessions. They're not going to take advantage of me in any way. They're going to do their best to speak in truth so I can trust what they say. And even though we aren't always successful with our speech, you know, at least we make a very strong attempt to engage in kind speech and to refrain from harsh speech. So there's a sense of safety and of refuge that we can give to the world just by practicing with these moral precepts. And just recollecting that in itself. That's a recollection of our power of our generosity. It can ease the mind, soothe the mind, gladden the mind. Then the another kind of giving is the gift of sharing Dhamma with people, sharing the teachings, sharing what we've gone through, our successes, our failures, our trials, our tribulations, our happinesses, with other people. And many people here are experienced enough, and that even if you don't do formal teaching, the amount of informal sharing with other people is an act of generosity. And whatever we can do to establish people in this path of practice is an incredible gift, because it's the one that actually will, you know, lead to a much more long-term stability in how to deal with difficulties, how to end suffering. So that's recollecting the times that we've shared Dhamma with other people in whatever way we can do it, even if it's, you know, just some kind supportive words to a fellow practitioner or encouragement, then that's very worthy of recollection. And kind of where Chaga Nisati branches out even further is in a kind of a more extended definition, where moving from giving, it moves towards the giving over, giving up, with a sense of relinquishment. So it's not just the giving of things or the giving of time or the giving of Dhamma. It's actually relinquishment. It's a letting go that's implied with that practice, with that word as well. Letting go of notions of selfishness, letting go of the suffering in our lives, wanting to relinquish, giving up the habits, the underlying tendencies of greed and aversion and confusion, wanting to give up clinging and attachments, so that there is this possibility for experiencing a freedom that's not related to all the things in the world. So it's kind of at that point that some of the recollections of where the practice can really lead us, the place that the goal, if you will, of the practice of complete freedom can be just itself a recollection. That even if we're not at that point of complete relinquishment yet in our practice, we can bring that up as a perception, as a very skillful contemplation. This contemplation of what the Buddha calls the contemplation of the peace of Nibbana, that we can bring that up as a way of softening the mind, of gladdening the mind, of settling. It's kind of almost a faith kind of a practice in a way, in that we may not be at that point of being able to completely relinquish clinging and attachment in our own lives, but we can realize that this is what the potential is, and we can establish that appreciation of what it might be like as a way of developing an open-hearted state of mind. And you know, the Buddha doesn't go into excruciating detail about it, because it's kind of beyond words, beyond description in conventional terms. But you know, he does describe some of the potential that's involved in that kind of freedom of mind. And essentially, it's you know, a way that I find that's useful to reflect on that is, is just to pose it again with some skillful questions. You know, when you're sitting quietly, with a relatively stable sense of mind, and just watching real clearly, as clearly as you can, the movements of mind, and watching to see how there'll be these periods where there's engagement with a thought or with a feeling or with a mood, and then you'll catch yourself and be able to let it go, let it pass, let it subside. And even if it's just for a brief moment, there might be a period of quiet and stillness as a result of that recognition and release. And just for that very brief moment of non-clinging, you get a sense of a hint of what it might be like to not let that mind just pull you around all the time, to watch it stop its movement and come to a place of stillness, and to think, well, maybe there's a little sense of this is what it might be like to let go of clinging, that habit of mind that wants to always move out and engage or move away from and avoid or just to be there even. What does it feel like just to completely give up that tendency, to completely relinquish that? Because that's the essential thing that needs to happen, as we're told, is to let go of that clinging, let go of that attachment. What would it be like if I can experience that in just a very momentary experience? What might it be like to realize that fully? So that there's activities that come into the mind, different kinds of experiences, but they're all seen clearly for what they are, and they're not acted upon through wanting or through aversion or through confusion. There's a state of clarity, absolute clarity, and absolute putting down, relinquishment, absolute contentment with the way things are, even if an unpleasant experience comes in through the mind, that it's known, it's experienced just for what it is, it's not held on to, not run away from, it just has a life of its own. And surrounding it, whatever it is, pleasant or unpleasant, is this sense of release and peace. Non-entanglement, non-complication. So just resting with that as a perception, bringing that into mind as a potential. Bringing that up as a recollection for practice. And even if we're not there, we can take the light in the fact that it is a potential, it's a possibility. It's within our capacity. So these kinds of recollections, like with the relinquishment, with the chaga, the giving, the recollection of the potential of peace in mind through non-clinging, the potential for what complete transformation of mind that this practice can result in, as well as the other kinds of recollections of our harmlessness, of our ability to to give, of our ability to offer kindness, compassion, simplicity, renunciation, treading lightly on the world. All of these things are really useful kinds of recollections that we can bring into our mind, even when the rest of the practice is not going as we wish. We can't concentrate, we can't sit quietly for very long. We can bring up some more of these kinds of wholesome recollections, where how to live our lives in a way that is in accord with the Eightfold Path, and really develop all of those factors of the Eightfold Path, not only the samadhi aspect of it, but all the other aspects that make it a complete path. So I think I'll leave it there for today.